It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's been a wild week with Foxconn, first saying the company would not produce LCD screens at its proposed Mount Pleasant facility, then today saying it would proceed with its original plan. We'll talk to a lawyer about the environmental concerns that still persist with the manufacturing plant. First, for home cooks, one of the hardest parts of getting dinner made on a weeknight can be just deciding what recipe to make in the first place. Maybe you've had this experience at 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night. You just got home from work and now you're flipping through the recipe book or scrolling through the endless recipes on Pinterest, not sure where you should even start. That's where our next guest and her cookbook come in. Pam Anderson is a New York Times bestselling author of 8 cookbooks, including the James Beard-nominated first edition of How to Cook Without a Book, Recipes and Techniques Every Cook Should Know by Heart. She recently released a completely revised and updated edition of that book. Pam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, in your book, you talk about how you got started on this project and your own struggles, you know, even as a food professional, getting dinner on the table as a working mom in the 1990s. Can you tell us about that
That's true.
It inspired you?
That's exactly right. I was the food editor of a magazine, and yet I knew how to follow a recipe like the best of them, but I would still come home for dinner, as you just described, on a Tuesday night at 6:30, and just open the refrigerator and stare. There would be some meat in there, there would be eggs, and there would be maybe some vegetables, but I just didn't know how to put it together without a recipe. And it made me think about my mom and my grandmom and how they had managed to pull off dinner every night without a cookbook. I think my mom maybe owned 2 cookbooks. My grandmother didn't own a single one. And I realized what they had a set of techniques and a set of formulas that they used, and they used those and slid in whatever meat was on sale at the grocery store, whatever vegetables were in season. And I realized that that's what I needed to do. But the problem was I didn't have the kind of time that they had, and I had a vast array of ingredients that they had. So I realized that I needed to come up with my own techniques and my own formulas that would work with my life and my time schedule.
One idea that I love that you talk about is maybe when you're cooking, you have a little more time today, make an ingredient, make a part of a meal that's going to work tomorrow as well. It can be part of a thing that I throw together quickly tomorrow. Can you give a couple of examples of how you do that?
Yes. You did. You did read the book. Thank you very much. For example, it takes no time to soak a pound of beans. And if you remember to soak your beans, it just takes 6 cups of water and a tablespoon of salt. That way the beans actually taste seasoned. You soak those overnight. They're done in 30 minutes the next day when you actually cook them, and you can use those beans in any number of preparations. You can throw a couple of ham hocks in a pot and turn that pot on and let it simmer until you're ready to go to bed, and you've got a wonderful broth ready to go the next night. And then all you have to do is saute some vegetables up, add your broth, and put your little bits of ham in there and take those white beans, and you've got soup. So saute some bacon, some sausage. When you're roasting vegetables at night, don't just roast one pan, roast 2. Those vegetables can be an amazing start to a vegetarian pizza, or I use those roasted vegetables and drizzle them with vinaigrette and use them for salad the next night. I use those same vegetables from the night before and I can make a wonderful frittata in the morning. So never just cook for one meal. Always be thinking ahead. For example, the simple tomato sauce, it's really just a little bit of garlic in oil, and I do a little bit of red pepper flakes, but you can make one can. Well, guess what? That only feeds you for one meal. If you just quadruple that recipe and take 4 cans and do the same thing, you've got meals for the rest of the week. So there are just so many ways that you can make more than you actually need so that you've got what I call money in the bank.
We are talking to Pam Anderson about the newly revised version of her book, How to Cook Without a Book. Let's take this to the grocery store, Pam, because I got to say, I've had times, not lately, I'm happy to say, but back in the day where, hey, I just went grocery shopping yesterday. Now I got to make a quick meal. And I can't figure out what to make. So obviously something went wrong at the grocery store. Talk about your philosophy while you're shopping for food.
Well, I just go into the store, and it's a little bit like what I said about my mom. I look to see what vegetables. I used to get so frustrated when chefs would say, oh, I just went to the farmer's market and picked up all these things, and because I didn't know how to just pick up ingredients and know what to do with them. But when I internalize my formulas, like my soup formula and the stir fry formula, I know that all of those formulas, for example, start with a pound of meat, a pound of vegetables. They each call for an onion, and I can take that pound formula and know, oh, okay, if I've got these vegetables and a pound of meat and a pound of vegetables, I can make soup tomorrow. I can make stir fry tomorrow. I can also take, for example, if that pound of meat, if it's chicken breast, boneless, skinless chicken breast, or a steak, or boneless pork chops, I can take that same meat and pound of vegetables, and a starch, and either pan sear or saute the cut, and then have a standard vegetable, you know, rice, for example, or a wonderful sauteed or seared cut of meat with a first-class, first-rate, restaurant-style pan sauce, which takes just a couple of minutes after you're done searing or sauteing your cut.
One strategy I love is taking two chickens and making multiple meals out of it. You could do this with rotisserie chicken you talk about. You could do it if you're roasting the chickens yourself. But then you're not just plopping the chicken down on the table for people to eat. Talk about how you get creative and make multiple meals by planning ahead when you've got a whole chicken.
That's right. Well, I used to buy one chicken, and we would just kind of squander it. Everybody would be fighting over the legs and thighs. We would kind of like divvy up some of the breast meat, and there would always be some hanging out left over. And then I would throw the carcass away. Well, now I always just buy two, so that the first night I take off the legs and thighs, and I make I can coat those with Dijon mustard and breadcrumbs. I've got a formula for a glaze that you can use just about any jam or jelly that you have in your refrigerator, whether it's peach or fig or cherry or orange marmalade, any of those. And you can make a wonderful glaze, put that over the chicken, and roast those legs and thighs. And they taste like you roasted them from scratch when you roast them again. And it only takes like 15 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes to re-roast them. And it's amazing. Then you take off your breast meat, and you can use that breast meat to do any number of things, whether it's create pulled chicken and make it for, you know, make a flavoring and serve it for tacos, or you can do barbecue pulled chicken or use it in soup. And then the bones, of course, you take all those bones and skin left over, and you use that to make some of the best broth you can make. I've made all kinds of chicken broths from scratch, starting off, you know, with raw chickens and all that. The best chicken broth you can make is using rotisserie chickens.
Yeah, I do that. I love that.
Yes. So it's a great way to get three or four meals out of two chickens for four people.
Now, part of this, there's a psychology element here. Some people are listening and thinking, sure, of course, I cook this way all the time. Some people don't have that confidence. They've got to stick with a recipe. They're not ready to take that leap to improvise with what's in the fridge or what looks good at the store today. How do you motivate them? How do you get them to take on this mentality?
Well, I do give you the formula, and I, you know, so that you do have a step-by-step. It's really like a textbook. I mean, it's a delicious, beautiful textbook in that you've got pictures and illustrations, and so it's fun to look at. But I do walk you through step by step as though it were a recipe, but I give you the freedom to put, and I give you the, I tell you what you could put in there. So you've got all the list of whether it's sausage or salmon, or I tell you, you know, what you could slide into this formula so I give you some training wheels, so to speak, on your recipe, so that you can follow it, but still have freedom and flexibility to use what you have. And I think that by giving you the formula, it gives you the confidence to do it. And I also play it out for you so that I give you examples of a couple of examples of like which meat and vegetables you should try together so that you've got some ideas and something to work with, so you're not just, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure what to add.
We're talking to Pam Anderson about her cookbook, How to Cook Without a Book, Recipes and Techniques Every Cook Should Know by Heart. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this how you cook? Do you have a go-to technique when you raid the fridge, see what you got, and make something out of it? Do you have some favorite meals you've made that way? What did it take for you to get to that point where you could cook that way? Or do you have a question for our guest about how to use what's in your fridge maybe right now to make something great this weekend? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Pam Anderson. She's the author of the now updated book, How to Cook Without a Book, Recipes and Techniques Every Cook Should Know by Heart. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these go-to techniques to make stuff, make food out of whatever stuff you have in the fridge, in the larder, a stew, a stir-fry, a jambalaya, what have you, that you can just make with what you got? Do you have questions about how to do this? And do you have things where you prepare ingredients ahead of time so that, you know, when you're in that pinch, in that crunch time, you can get it together fast? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Melody is with us in Madison. Melody, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I just wanted to say that something that's really helped me a lot in this process of using what's available and thinking beyond the recipe was actually getting involved with a community-supported agriculture, a CSA-type program here in Madison, where you get, each week, you just get this box of really fresh local vegetables and what's in season that week. And you are really forced and challenged me in a good way to think outside of my normal patterns and to try new vegetables. Like, one week it's like, okay, we got a lot of parsnips. What am I going to do with parsnips this week? You know, or things that I may not just go to in the grocery store, but also just then trying to think creatively about how am I going to use all of these peppers and what can I do with that? So if anyone's interested in exploring, that's been a really fun experience to kind of push me out of my rut, my cooking rut.
Melody, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm right there with you. And Pam, actually, you give a few different ways to use miscellaneous vegetables. We're coming out of days of negative temperatures as our highs in Wisconsin. Let's talk about oven roasting. Share a basic technique that's going to work for a lot of different kinds of vegetables.
Yeah, you can take just about any vegetable you've got and simply cut those vegetables into large bite-sized chunks and toss them with olive oil, salt, and pepper. You can throw on dried herb. My go-to is thyme. And just toss those vegetables on a large roasting pan, rimmed baking sheet, and put them in the oven at a 425-degree oven. And you've got beautiful roasted vegetables that you can enjoy for dinner that night, and then save the rest of them for, as I said earlier, you can make a wonderful frittata in the morning, and that takes no time, really. And you can serve that frittata also. I love eggs for dinner as well. You can throw those roasted vegetables on a vegetarian pizza. You can throw those vegetables into a soup and shortcut making soup so that the vegetables are already cooked through. You can use those roasted vegetables and make a wonderful bean and grain salad that you can serve warm or in the summer. You might want that room temperature or chilled. So there's all kinds of ways. And as I said, you can also just toss it with vinaigrette, drizzle it with vinaigrette, and serve it for salad. So there are all kinds of, and you can also toss those with pasta and have a roasted vegetable pasta.
Melody, thanks again for calling in. We'll go now to Suzanne in Racine. Suzanne, hi.
Hi, how you doing, Rob?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I'm making a frittata right now, and it's sort of a mishmash of, I'm using kind of a crust from some squash. I roasted a few days ago, and I'm roasting some zucchini to put in it. And as long as I'm roasting the zucchini, I thought, well, I might as well roast some green and red peppers and some carrots to use in a later recipe. So I'm totally down with this style of cooking.
You're doing that right now, Suzanne. That's fantastic. Thanks a lot, Pam. All right, thanks a lot, Suzanne. And Pam, you talk about that, and I've been in this situation where, you know, it's not really much harder to make four quiches than it is to make two quiches. It's not, as Suzanne was saying, much harder to make two pans of roasted vegetables than one pan of roasted vegetables.
That's exactly my belief. And like I said, with the tomato sauce, it's just almost as easy to open four cans as one. If you're going to go ahead and heat up a pot, just throw in a few more cans, and not only will that, can you use that as the classic tomato sauce to toss with pasta, but you can use it as a base to make all kinds of things that you wouldn't even think of. Like, you can make a quick chili, you can make a quick bolognese, you can make quick tomato sauce, tomato soup. You can make a pasta fagioli, that Italian vegetable soup. There, you can make a clam chowder, a New York style clam chowder, Manhattan clam chowder. So having that simple tomato sauce that's been flavored with garlic and already cooked really jump starts dinner the next night if you've got a quart of that in your refrigerator.
Suzanne, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Pam Anderson about the new edition, the revised edition of her book, How to Cook Without a Book. By the way, a few recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday, that trifecta of chicken recipes. You can make a rotisserie chicken or baked chicken go a lot longer and a lot more creatively. Three of those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday from Pam. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to ask about, Mark?
Well, I am a 60-plus-year-old bachelor, and I cook for myself, and I would like to know how not to overcook, because right now I cook enough for two meals. I eat it for supper, I eat it for lunch the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, thanks for the call. Any advice, Pam, on cooking for one for Mark?
Well, I would still say, if he cooked even like a soup, for example, most of my soup formula serves a generous four people. But as long as he doesn't put potatoes in it, his starch is like beans or pasta or rice, I would enjoy that soup for dinner and then lunch the next day, and I would package that rest of that soup up and put it in the freezer. And then 2 weeks down the road, when you don't feel like cooking, guess what? You can pull out a container of that soup and you've got a meal without having to do anything at all.
Mark, thanks. Hope that helps. And Pam, you do make a big case for using that freezer. My problem is I kind of lose touch with what's in my freezer. Any organizational advice so that I know what I've got there and it's easily accessible and ready to rock?
Well, it's not fair to ask me because I actually made sure that I had, in my house, I have a full refrigerator and a full freezer side by side. So I have a very big freezer. It's pretty full. I have one shelf of kind of bread and buns and any kind of bready thing is on that level. And then I have a meat level. So all of my protein, I use a lot of vegetarian sausages and burgers and that sort of thing. And then the next level is my prepared things, my tomato sauces, my soups, my prepared foods, that things that I've made and cooked, and what I call my money in the bank. And then the next level is sweets, desserts, and things like that. So I kind of have it shelf by shelf. But I realize if you've got a side-by-side or a over-the-top standard freezer, if you don't have a dedicated freezer, it's a little hard to put up a lot of food, that's for sure.
I want to talk about...
Go ahead.
I want to jump in, Pam. I want to talk about one more technique before we're out of time. I love this one. The shove it in the oven stew formula, where you make stew out of just about anything. I love this when my kids were little. Nap time, okay, get that stew together, get in the oven. It cooks after they wake up. Talk about the basic principle of your shove it in the oven stew.
Well, I started it because I went with one of my books, and it started out as a recipe that I developed. And that was the most popular recipe in one of my books called Perfect One Dish Dinners. And everybody loved it so much. And I thought, well, I took it to the formula level, and it really worked. And the beautiful thing about it is you just throw your onion and your garlic and whatever, you know, the meat choices would be, like chicken thighs, so any kind of sausages, whether they're smoked or fresh, and your vegetables, and you basically drizzle it with olive oil and some sort of acid, vinegar, wine, and then you just shove that in the oven. And then at the end, there are a couple of things that if you want to make it a seafood stew, you obviously would add the seafood the last 10 minutes or so of cooking. I add the beans, canned beans. There are a few things that you can add. You add at the end because you want those. You want the oven to essentially kind of saute those vegetables first before they start to give off their liquid. But it is an amazing technique, and I use that technique a lot, particularly when I'm serving a large crowd. And I just shove that, just throw all that stuff in the roasting pan, and 45 minutes later, out it comes, and it smells and tastes like you've spent all afternoon on it, and you basically threw everything in the roasting pan, and that was it. So it is one of my favorite techniques, as is the petite roast dinner, because everybody thinks they have to wait till Sunday afternoon to have a roast dinner, when in fact you can have, if you choose the right cut and the right vegetables, you can have a roast dinner in about a half an hour on a weeknight, and that's pretty special.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Pam Anderson. We've been talking about the new edition of her book, How to Cook Without a Book, Recipes and Techniques Every Cook Should Know. It seemed as though a multi-billion dollar between Wisconsin and Taiwan-based Foxconn Technology Group might have been on the rocks this week after the company said it would not make LCD screens at its proposed Mount Pleasant facility. While Foxconn reiterated that it planned on staying in the state and was merely shifting its focus from manufacturing to research and development, it rattled state lawmakers. The company changed course today after its chairman spoke with President Trump. While the dust seems to have settled for now on the Foxconn issue, it highlighted concerns that some groups still have over the deal, including the environmental impact the company could have when manufacturing gets underway. Our next guest is here to talk about her group's challenge to the Foxconn deal and its pending lawsuit against the state DNR. Jody Habish-Sinikin is an attorney with Midwest Environmental Advocates and teaches for the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. Jody, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
So the news has gone back and forth this week on Foxconn, but all through it, you've been worried about what water diversion and water quality issues might be raised by the facility. What are your main concerns?
Our main concerns have been from the beginning the fact that the approval of this diversion to supply the Foxconn facility is one that is illegal under the Great Lakes Compact. Stated simply, the compact prohibits private diversions to solely private users and instead requires that any diversion of Great Lakes water outside the basin be for public water supply purposes, defined as largely residential. In this instance, the water that will be diverted to the out-of-basin portion of Mount Pleasant will solely go to the manufacturing, industrial, commercial facility that Foxconn had initially announced.
Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the water diversion that was approved for Foxconn?
Well, the DNR back in April, Walker's DNR had approved a diversion request by the city of Racine for 7 million gallons per day to go for the industrial purposes of Foxconn's water-intensive manufacturing facility for these LCD panels. it was going to require quite a bit of water, and that was what was approved. So at that point, that was where the facts that were available, and that was what the DNR did approve. The fact that cannot be avoided, however, is that there are no public or residential purposes for that water in that area. Primarily, all of the folks or the residents who were in that area have been removed by Mount Pleasant. Up to 80% of that land has been purchased and the homes removed. And the new infrastructure of pipes and mains that would go to supply the Foxconn facility also would not supply largely residential users. Again, completely to the contrary, it would go to the sole use of Foxconn.
So your group, Midwest Environmental Advocates, has a lawsuit pending against the state DNR over this water diversion. Why did your group originally pursue that litigation?
We pursued it because we believe in the Great Lakes Compact and what it stands for in terms of the protection of the Great Lakes, not just for our generation, of course, but for many, many generations to come. And the Great Lakes Compact is only as good as it is enforced. And a core provision of the Great Lakes Compact is its ban on diversions of water. And a core threshold of that is that no diversions can go for solely private purposes, as is the case in the Foxconn diversion.
Talking to Jody Habish-Sinikin with Midwest Environmental Advocates about the Foxconn plant, some back and forth news this week, and water diversion from the Great Lakes for use at the Foxconn facility. Are there, in addition to diversion, Jody, are there concerns about water quality in the water that is used and then, I guess, leaves the plant?
Yes, that will be in the future in terms of other permits that would proceed in terms of water quality under the Clean Water Act and what kind of technology would be required by the city of Racine to treat that water. But there have been quite a number of concerns raised regarding the type of chemicals and toxins that would be involved in this manufacturing process if, in fact, it does proceed.
Are you concerned that if this diversion goes unchallenged or if your challenge is rejected, that it sets a precedent for other future diversions for industrial use?
Absolutely. This is a diversion, as I stated, that violates the core principle of the Great Lakes Compact. States around the region have communicated their concern that the Walker DNR's interpretation violates their interpretation, as well as, interestingly, it violates Wisconsin's own prior interpretation of public water supply purposes. In both the Waukesha and the New Berlin diversion approvals by Wisconsin's own prior DNRs, they made very clear that any diversion would have to go to public water supply purposes within the diversion area, not looking at a system as a whole, but to the particular diversion area at issue. In this case, the Foxconn facility located in the out-of-basin portion of Mount Pleasant is the diversion area of concern.
Now, there will be those who argue that the need for jobs and economic development outweighs some of the concerns about the scope of the diversion. And the company says any water it diverts will be cleaned and treated before it's returned to Lake Michigan. Is there a case to be made that the economic potential here outweighs concerns about diversion?
The Great Lakes Compact is very conscious of creating economic opportunities and protecting them within the Great Lakes Basin. It is very much about protecting the greatest resource that our region has, and that goes to economic opportunities as well. In this particular instance, all that would be required is for the water manufacturing facility portion of Foxconn to be moved, a few hundred yards east or within the basin for there not to even be a diversion at all. So it really is something that the Great Lakes Compact would certainly accommodate and facilitate growth within the basin under the terms of the compact. So there is no conflict there.
So in your lawsuit, is that your goal, that they move a little closer so they're inside the basin as defined by the compact?
Well, if the Foxconn facility were moved, if the Wisconsin DNR required that move of that short distance, then there wouldn't be a diversion of Great Lakes water. And there would be a revision of the approval such that the Foxconn facility would proceed under the terms of the compact, but not as a diversion itself. So what our lawsuit is looking to establish is that the Great Lakes Compact's core provisions should be upheld and interpreted as appropriate to what the framers of the compact intended and what the rest of the region and our own state history has demonstrated to be the one most protective of the resource.
And finally, Jody, what is the timeline for your lawsuit now?
Right now, we have briefs pending before an administrative law judge, and that will be reviewed. And sometime in the spring, we expect there to be a decision.
Jody, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Jody Habish-Sinikin, Attorney of Counsel with Midwest Environmental Advocates. She teaches for the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. She was with us today to talk about ongoing environmental concerns surrounding the Foxconn plant in Mount Pleasant and a pending lawsuit against the state DNR over the company's water diversion request. We all probably have some things we wish we hadn't gotten rid of. Maybe you still kick yourself for not keeping your record collection. You wish you hadn't donated all your bell bottoms or gotten rid of some of your mother's dishware. It does seem that many things that once seemed old and outdated soon become vintage and desirable. It's hard to imagine that some of our modern possessions would someday be antique store worthy. What does it take to become a valuable antique? Is it just the passing of time? Our guest says this is something antiques dealers often think about. Dwayne Scott Cerny is the co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market, Chicago's oldest and largest vintage shopping destination. He's the author of the book, Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. Dwayne, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. Well, this brings up just kind of a core question. What turns a thing into an antique?
Magic. Turns it into an antique. I think, you know, we go back and forth between the word antique, and people get stuck into that. You know, it has to be 100 years old, it has to be 50 years old, and the word vintage.
Okay.
And certainly antique dealers tend to embrace the word vintage. I would say it's a kind of a curiosity of time and kismet, which can turn something that was once unwanted and worthless into something valuable and desirable. I think I start, if I can kind of just offhand, speaking generally, one should really look for good design. I would say like better pieces, things that were quality items. Now, you know, stores we could name, such as, you know, Target or wherever, contemporary shopping ventures. You can really spot the good stuff from the junk. Let's just be honest. So quality, and you know, so, and it's a word that, you know, ignore these days, you know, I'm afraid, but, you know, how well something is made, you know, just the weight of it, the scale of it, and sometimes the price. So, you know, many things that are expensive tend to be expensive in the future. Things that were inexpensive sometimes remain inexpensive or completely worthless.
I can look around, you know, my kitchen or living room, whatever, and feel like it's just my daily ordinary stuff. But I guess if we're buying something that's vintage now or antique now, that was the people back then who owned it thought of it the same way, right? It took time for it to have that special vintage feel about it.
Absolutely. But I mean, you could if we looked about your kitchen, and that's a good example, and say you'd picked up a Michael Graves or a Philippe Starck tea kettle, both of them sold a hell of a lot of those, and really desirable, you know, as an 80s, 90s thing, really good design, expensive in its time, a really good piece to have now. So again, architect design or made by designers. It seems that we've kind of gone back to that, with those of us who remember the whole pedigree of the 80s and the whole designer fashion element. So things that like Chanel and Tiffany and Coach, those name brands, are just as significant now, if not more so, especially with young people. So I just don't see that going away. I just see that really expanding. They're just such brand names in our heads now. They're not going to disappear.
Now we hear a lot about fast fashion and cheaper furniture and things like that. It seems like a lot of the things we're buying these days just physically aren't going to survive long enough to become vintage. Is this new, or has that always been around?
It's a really good point. Well, here, a store such as IKEA, when they began, it really did quality pieces that are still floating around. And there's many a vintage dealer, including myself, that has sold one of the early IKEA pieces. Unfortunately, that really can't be said of much of what they're creating today in, spatula world at IKEA. So that's changed. So, and then I kind of just spin back to the quality of manufacture. So,
we are talking about antiques and vintage items and play a little mental guessing game here. What are the things we own today that are going to be desirable vintage items in the future, maybe antiques if they stick around long enough? Dwayne Scott Cerny is with us, co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market, author of Selling Dead People's Things, Inexplicably True Tales, Vintage Fails, and Objects of Objectionable Estates. Dwayne, I know you can't predict the future, but as you look around, are there particular items or brands or things like that you say, yeah, I bet, your successor 50 years, 100 years from now, they're going to be like really paying good bucks for this stuff?
Well, I really encourage people to look at things and be really open-minded about things. And I'll tell a quick story of, I used to go to house sales and be called into estates. And I noticed that the people doing the sales would often, whenever they had film negatives from cameras, just the film, they'd throw it out. They would just throw it out. And I started telling these people, put it in a bag. Just put it in a bag. Whenever you get one of these things, just put it in a bag. And then, a couple months later, someone would come to me with thousands of negatives. Like, am I out of my mind? No, because if you think about it, we all have these wonderful cameras in our pockets, and we take billions of photographs. And how many of them do we print?
Very few. Remarkably very few.
Very few. Unfortunately, yet that having that object, and a negative is an object, it's very much a dead technology. I'm big interest in cameras, of course, right? Collectible cameras. But the film itself, not so much. Now, when I was doing it again 10 years ago, people thought I was a little off. I have a hard time even keeping that in stock. I have young people asking for it for all the time, and for many, many reasons. I mean, we sold them to ad agencies, and people use them for art projects, and countless things I can't even imagine. So now, look at that's essentially garbage. I would not be surprised if good packaging, even the packaging itself, could in fact one day be desirable. And now I'm not encouraging everybody to be hoarding this.
Right.
I've walked into enough of those houses. You kind of have to have a discerning eye and say, what is unusual about this? What excites me about this? Why is this speaking to me? So again, it's really being open-minded to objects in a different way. So and don't look at things necessarily for like, hey, 30 years from now, I can make $10 on this. It's really not where we're going. But just like anything else, you should collect things that you love. And there's an expression that like today's design is the new art. Is that it's just to the public that we so embrace good design, which has always kind of been there, but it's not something that we've really discussed so openly and embraced so lovingly. go ahead.
Is there an arc of, I've got this phrase in my head, the arc of embarrassment, where, okay, bell bottoms, yeah, they were big. Oh my God, I can't believe we wore those things. Then they came back. I'm from the 80s. I was a teenager in the 80s. So much stuff I would not go back to. And now I see a lot of that stuff is coming back into style. Is this something that happens again and again? We poo-poo the thing and then it comes back.
Oh gosh. How many times have Mohawks come back? 3, 4 that I can count. that type of fashion. But again, I often spin back to antiques and vintage is a fashion. It's not so much of a trend word, as it is again kind of opening yourself up to experiencing these things, because you could say, gee, I never want to see that again. It's like getting a bad haircut, you know. We don't want to do that again. But yes, so many things just repeat themselves. In the 80s, everyone was, you know, crazy about the stuff from the 50s. In the 90s, everyone was crazy about stuff from the 60s. Yeah, it's I do think as the decades go on, there are fewer and fewer things, because it seems to me that the quality of items is just lessened as the decades proceed. Things just aren't made as well, so there are fewer things that may in fact become collectible and desirable, which is why I say just be open to everything from things that would be disposable or, you know, the dead technology. Good example is those first cell phone. You know, if anyone remembers that brick that you'd walk around with, right? You said that one, dead technology. Those were in thrift stores. Nobody wanted them. Couldn't give them away. Wow, you'd want one now. I mean, those are museum pieces.
People are
collecting them. Some of the first computers. So there's that in the technology of it. I'm really excited about where this is going to be. This whole business is going to be in 25, 30, 50 years from now, even though I'm not going to be around, is because when you look at virtual reality and 3D and the ways that people shop online now, where that's going to be, it's cool because vintage doesn't go away. I'm selling to an entirely new generation of collectors. I learned so much from them. And that's the other thing I would say, is that people should talk to their friends. I mean, people, you know, sometimes, you know, if you're out shopping with others, what gets them excited? What do they think? You can learn so much from others. They'll tell you about some sale they went to and something they saw and they didn't buy. Everybody's got a story about the thing that got away. But there's a huge interest now in vintage gym shoes, you know, Nike, Adidas, Reebok, you know. So something that could be from, you know, 2010 and it's desirable and valuable, which was kind of, you know, a little mind-blowing to me because I wasn't into it, but within that kind of genre of collectability, there's you can learn something every day in the vintage business.
Dwayne, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob. This has been great.
That's Dwayne Scott Cerny, co-owner of the Broadway Antique Market in Chicago. He's the author of the book Selling Dead People's Things. He joins today to talk about what might be for sale in the antique stores of the future. Let us know. Do you have the one that got away, that item that's maybe collectible now that you tossed years ago? Email ideas@WPR.org. With the cold weather this week in Wisconsin, we wanted to distract ourselves with a little thought of baseball. Yesterday, we talked about possible names for the Brewers Stadium. Now, we also saw in the news the new name and logo for the Traverse City Northwoods League team. As of this week, they are known as the Pit Spitters, after the region's well-known cherry industry. Producer Bill Martin is in the studio with me. Bill, this got you hunting for some other fun minor and semi-pro team names.
This is what I love about lower level baseball, is that the nicknames and the logos are just awesome. So one of my favorite ones is the Montgomery Biscuits. Montgomery, okay. Alabama, figure biscuits, Southern fare,
sure.
You know,
yeah,
makes
yeah.
sense. The logo is actually a biscuit that's cut in half, and it's kind of open, you know, like an open mouth.
Uh-huh.
And they've got a couple of goofy eyes and a pad of butter for the tongue.
Okay.
That's just awesome. So that's my favorite. There's also the Savannah Bananas, which is just fun to say.
Just the rhyme. Yeah,
right.
I love that.
Closer to home, the Brewers actually have a minor league affiliate in Colorado Springs. Due to a multi-team shift, they kind of have an expansion team thing there now. And so they had a vote on what the new name should be, and it's the Rocky Mountain Vibes.
Yeah.
Now you might think, what in the world is a Rocky Mountain Vibe? It's actually a s'more that looks like Guy Fieri.
Yeah, the logo is really out of control.
And then in the Northwoods League up in Green Bay, there's the Booyah, which is it used to be the Bullfrogs.
Right.
Now they're the Booyah.
That's this famous Belgian stew that's popular in the area.
Right, and it's a hacked-off looking rooster in a cauldron, and I'd look upset too.
Yeah, if I had a cauldron on my head, somebody's trying to put it, I'd be an angry rooster too.
Indeed. Absolutely.
All right. Let us know if you have a favorite minor league team name. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.